Certainly, for the first time in a long time, we are seeing prices, or we've seen prices coming down, which was not the case for, you know, for those 2 years through and just after COVID.
Cool, thanks very much for tuning in. So we're just doing a podcast here today in Newmarket. We've got Chris Fairbairn with us. How are you, mate?
Good, thank mate,
you
yourself?
Yeah, good. Few notes on you. I've done a little bit of background research, and obviously we've been chatting. Businessman, board of Auckland Rugby and Coast Guard, studied Bachelor of Economics in Otago. How many Hyde Street parties have you been to?
Yeah, a few. Nice. A few catches burnt.
I did find you on the NZ Herald last night on the power list. Is that for being a Mitre 10 owner?
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, yep. Very, very powerful.
Yeah, nice. Believe it or not, an avid squash player for New Zealand, family man, and a startup investor.
So there we go.
Thanks for jumping in today. Obviously, our market is purely builders, residential guys, sort of under 10 staff. They absolutely love rinsing us for rates, what's happening in the industry. Obviously, materials is probably 30 or 40% of any kind of build cost. So I think it's very relevant that we get you in here today to ask you for a few things. So that'd be cool. We'll just start off real simple, and then I'd love to get into the nitty gritty. But how did you start off? And so post school, and then how did you end up at Mitre 10? What was sort of the process there?
Yeah, well, I guess went to uni in Otago, started working with Spates Breweries because that was the dream job for for an ex-Scarfy from Otago.
Cool.
And was in sales and marketing, moved up to Auckland, then went overseas for a couple of 3 years, running an Italian drinks company. Which was pretty cool. Had an office in Southern California, New York, London, and Italy. So that was 3 years of my life, which I won't remember again.
Do you remember what age you were at this time?
Oh, that would have been probably around 30.
Yeah.
Nice. So it was a bit of a blur, but it was good fun. Came back to Auckland, was the marketing director of Lion Breweries, so stayed in the booze game.
Yeah.
Then with a mate of mine, we bought half a dozen bars and restaurants around Auckland. We set up a number of startup companies, those little twisted shots you get when you rip the top off.
Yeah,
we invented those.
Do they come in the 12-pack colourful tops?
That's the ones.
What were they called?
Ours were called twisted shots, but yeah, they've been all over the place, and a few other things. We set up a quiz business, Texas Hold'em poker business, and a few other crazy ideas. And then I was involved with a company called V&C Cocktails. The founders of 42 Below, an offshoot of them. So I ran that company for 3 years, and then the stars and moon aligned, and I got involved with Placemakers in 2010. And went along to Mount Wellington, which was in Auckland, which was a sort of a smaller store then. Probably doing 35, 40 million in turnover in those days.
Back in what year would have that
been? 2010.
Yeah.
And I stayed with those guys. That model was a joint venture model back then, meaning that you had sort of 50-50 or share ownership with Fletcher's. That was my ultimate game, was to get into ownership of a business. And ultimately, after about 7 years, I got ownership of the New Lynn store just before COVID. And then COVID changed things in the Fletcher's world, and then they changed their model a bit, and it's now a sort of a hub model, mainly owned by Fletcher's. And so I made the decision back then that I still wanted to have ownership of a business, and was passionate and passionate about the building industry. So the Mitre 10 opportunity came up in Manukau, and so went through quite a grueling process to buy that business two years later. So that's sort of my quick journey.
Man, so much to unpack there, but I think a couple key questions. Obviously, you don't come from like a strict residential background, more of a marketing, business, and sales, which I think is really cool, because obviously a lot of questions I get personally is, what I want to do if I want to be my own boss? How do I have my own company? Do you need to have a business degree to run a business? So it's more, I feel like you've got more of a, you've studied it, but you've gone and sort of tested the waters, done startups, worked for multiple different companies. So it's quite interesting just having that can-do attitude. Or I think I'm a bit of a believer of just go and try it and do it. You see heaps of people saying, how do I do this? I want to do my own business. So Yeah, that's quite interesting. How long did the process take to like purchase Mitre 10, and can anyone just go and do it, or what's like the, how does it work? Because it's fascinating.
Quite a tricky process. So, and they don't come up for sale that often, especially the mega stores. They're pretty tightly held by the owners. So the process for me was, there was one, this one was for sale. Went through a process, a number of interviews, panel interviews, a lot of testing. Met with the CEO, put a proposal forward. Met with the owners of the business and went through a group interview with them, and then was finally the lucky, you know. So it's, and again, the reason for that is because it's a cooperative, so we own the business ourselves. So they want to make sure that the owners of those businesses have similar, you know, business ethics, or will fit the cooperative model. So, you know, I guess going through that process was really grueling, but I'm pleased it means the other guys in the cooperative are similarly aligned to me.
I found with the harder the barrier of entry to something, usually I find the better the rewards on the other end. I had like a rubbish removal startup thing, but the barrier to entry is so low that it's very competitive. And then when you get into something like QSing, or at your level, if you own a Mitre 10, because it's so hard, probably the risk, or the risk, the rewards are a lot higher. What was like the time frame of that first interview to like physically signing the paperwork and taking it over?
It would have been over 12 months.
That's a long time.
Yeah, a long time. And I think from the sort of the first, meet and greet with the CEO through the process, and then I had a bit of a restraint of trade from placemakers, weren't obviously very happy that I was leaving. So they gave me a holiday for 3 months at the end of my placemakers experience as well.
Yeah, nice. When you first took over Mitre 10, how many sort of like clients or builders did you have on the books from a trade perspective, not a retail? And then where are you at now, and how have you managed that growth?
Yeah, good question. So when I guess that was the attraction for me of coming. I'm really passionate about the building industry that part. And Mitre 10 as a business tends to be, they're retailers, or we're retailers. You know, we've got big store. We sell everything from brooms and brushes you know, everything in between. So I saw a real opportunity with the Mitre 10 brand to be able to get into the trade side of the business a lot more, and they certainly have in the time we've been there. So when I first got there, you know, we were probably, you know, we've grown four times the size in sort of 12, 18 months since we've been there. We went from the number 9 trade store in Auckland for Mitre 10 megas to number 1, number 36 in New Zealand to this month number 1 in sales. So we've had really big growth, but you know, it's because we're passionate about the what we do.
I'd say sales is probably the lifeline of any business, and obviously builders, I mean, probably, I don't know the stats, but I'm just going to throw a figure and say 70% of builders are always struggling for their next job, or like, when's the next job going to come? Like, how do you get that customer base? Like, what's your internal sales process? Do you guys market? Do you have a sales team? Like, how do you look at those numbers, and how do you measure KPIs or growth?
Yeah, look, again, good question. So for me, two sides. One's old school. We have, you know, we brought across, we've got a sales team of 6, really experienced, you know, sales guys, sales reps, guys and girls. And so they go out and do what they do. They're incentivized to go and hunt. And so we've got the old school method of, you know, relationships. And you know, I'm a firm believer in people deal with people. They deal with brands to give them comfort and confidence, but they really deal with people at the end of the day. So we've got a really strong sales team who are there to make sure they give great service, great price, and if they get it right, you'll stick with us, and they'll go and bring more people in. And then personally, I spend a lot of my time doing the other stuff. I get involved in these sorts of things. I use a sort of a business mentor. We bounce ideas off 24/7. We do social marketing. We do events. We do all the other stuff to try and bring people into our world.
Yeah, more
world.
Brand awareness.
100%.
Are you on TikTok yet? I laughed when I when I thought about TikTok, and then I posted a couple videos, and yeah, it went absolutely viral. So
right, I might have
to implement it in your business, mate.
I'll have a look.
We can run around the trade store and shoot some funny videos.
There we go. Yeah.
I just want to, I'd love to talk more about, like margins and money as we can. Obviously, the biggest thing for builders, I mean, I find smaller jobs bring higher margins, bigger jobs, new builds, commercial stuff, they're sort of operating like under 10 or 12%. Yes, the revenue's high. How do you, as a company, obviously, throughout COVID, I mean, shit, what did the sheet of jib get up to price? 40 bucks?
And more, right?
And more, and now it's back down to 22.
20 odds, yeah.
From a business perspective, how do you like protect those margins? And I'd love to know when you have to do price increases on loyal customers, that must be a pretty hard thing to do, whether it's an email or a phone call from a big client, for a big client.
Yeah, it's brutal. I mean, I think 5 or 10 years ago, it was much harder because I think through COVID, we've all become sadly really accustomed to getting a price increase.
Yeah, it's natural.
Whereas it's natural, right? So it's become an easier conversation. Pre-COVID, really difficult. But, you know, the number of price increases we see now are daily.
Mm.
And we used to see a price increase of sort of 4 or 5% and go, wow, that's really big.
Mm.
And we see a 4 or 5% these days and go,
not too bad, we'll suck it up.
That's pretty standard.
Yeah.
So what we're trying to do, and what we do is we look for alternatives. So we, because of our growth of our business, we leverage our relationships with our suppliers to make sure we can try to get the most competitive pricing in the market to genuinely pass on to to our builders. And we're looking for other options. If we can't buy a whatever it is, a one widget for that's gone up in price, what else can we do? And we try to give the builders as much notice as possible that we try to hold those prices for, we get that you've priced your job at X dollars a meter for whatever it is, or X dollars. We try as best we can to maintain that pricing because nothing worse, because you'll I don't want you to bleed money. It's not what we're here for. We're here to make you money.
Because you're on the power list, do you have any pushback against those bigger suppliers? Like, could you kick back at Fletcher's for jib and say, nah, we can't do this? Or are they just going to be like, sweet, see you later?
Yeah, sweet, see you later. Yeah, so all we can do with the suppliers is, they've got to make a margin, I guess, as well.
For sure.
And their costs have gone up. So we try to be as understanding as we can. I guess all we're trying to do is find alternatives as best we can. So can we import different products in from offshore? Mm. As a Mitre 10 business, we bring a lot of product in for the retail store from offshore. So what other things could we bring in?
Yeah.
The reality is we're still a small market in the bottom of the world, and we import a lot of stuff, and there's not a lot of alternatives. And so all we're trying to do is manage as best we can those relationships with those suppliers.
Yeah, it's tough, eh?
It's really tough.
I feel like probably I'd say jib and timber seems to be the most like commonly asked topic around meter rates and rates and stuff. What do you think about, obviously, all the people bringing in that like Chinese plasterboard stuff versus jib? Do you really think like jib has a huge, trying to think of the right word, but do you really think jib has a huge power over the standard plasterboard? Because at the end of the day, I think it's getting fixed off on the wall and then it's just getting plastered and painted, but Fletcher's seemed to lock it up with their...
they've done a great job with getting it specified. It's a great product. It's great systems. So they've got a dominant market share. Is it healthy? It's for debate, not for me to perhaps get involved in. But I think... jib's a tricky one, but as you said, we've seen the pricing come back into market forces have brought those prices back. Timber's come back from the dizzying heights, 4x2 back.
Yeah, nuts.
2 years ago was probably closer to, it's come back by
30%. What's a 90x45 at the moment? $5.60? $5.20?
Around.
Obviously, every trade business is different with how much they spend with you, etc. Yeah,
and I think that what we're seeing though too is, and I think it's really important to understand that we're now starting to see shortages in timber because the pricing has come back so much from those dizzying heights, and some of those smaller mills just can't afford to be selling this product at the pricing that we've been seeing in the last sort of 12 months.
Mm.
And so I'm sort of sensing we're going to see some price movement again, especially on the timber side, because we're starting to see shortages of some key lines already because they're not cutting as much, they're reducing shifts.
I think I read in the paper there might have been one in Gisborne or Hawke's Bay, but they've shut up after 30 years or something. Yeah. They just can't afford the cost now.
But even like when you look at the cost of logs, and then so the forestry gangs being laid off. So yeah. even if you did want to, you know, cut more timber, mm-hmm. the forestry guys aren't there, and the truck drivers have gone on to other jobs, so there's no trucks, there's not enough trucks in the yeah. road, and then the cost of driving those trucks has gone up and the fuel's gone up.
Oh man.
So yeah. there's some perfect storms coming on some of those things. So how do you control that? You know, again, we're a small market in yeah. the bottom of the world.
Yeah.
Only can do what we can do.
I was going to ask this question last, but relevant to this point. What's sort of like, what do you predict for like 2024 in regards of, prices for you guys and maybe the industry from your insight at a high level?
Yeah, I think we're starting to see stability.
Yeah,
certainly for the first time in a long time, we are seeing prices, or we've seen prices coming down, which was not the case for, you know, for those 2 years through and just after COVID. So, you know, we're starting to see now a reduction in in prices across a variety of products, and I think we're expecting to see a bit of a mixed bag. I think we're going to, as I said before, yeah, I think we expect to see some timber increases because of those forces. Other commodities don't know. I think we'll have some flat, some down, and some up. I think we're going to have a mixed bag.
Yeah, okay. In regards of stability in the market, do you think change of government helping, going to help things?
Yeah, I mean, massive.
With the trade sector?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, business confidence, I was reading today, is up 8%, highest since 2015 or 2016.
Yeah, it's good.
That's not by chance, right? Yeah. So change government's given some real impetus. I think the changes to the bright line test for investors will make a big difference. So so yes, I think the building industry, but again, we've still got some, there'll be a lag
Before that comes into effect.
I
feel like I'm not a massive political fan, but I think obviously with one term's been in for so long, a new one gets in, it's going to take a while for all the policies to change and stuff to come into effect, and then it's kind of like we might be 3 or 4 years down the track before we actually see real change or growth. Would you agree?
Yeah, look, I think there's a desire to move faster. I think if they can, you know, I look at that bridge they built down in 25A, and it's they've done it in 4 months or something ridiculous, and you can see what they can do when there's a desire for you know, for real progress and for cutting red tape.
Yeah.
And I think there's, like, I don't know what the government are clearly going to do, but I think there's a real desire, real appetite to move fast. How fast can they move? Don't know.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
With the shortage of housing stuff, do you think that is going to, or I personally hope that that's going to obviously increase, we'll build more houses, obviously more business for everyone. Do you see the sort of volume build sector come back a bit better? Because I think renovations has probably had more stability, or like people sort of been chasing that market more. We've personally seen a lot of volume build guys looking for work, going to resi builders looking for jobs. Do you think the volume build stuff will come back? Is that what you're seeing?
Yeah, exactly what we're seeing. You know, those group home builders or volume builders have done it tough over the last 12 months, and we've seen the same thing. A lot of those guys have been moving on to smaller jobs. Some are moving into commercial. But the feedback we're getting very clearly is their workload, their books are now getting full, and the inquiries are coming back. And I think so we're starting to see those guys in particular returning into the market, which is positive for everybody.
Yeah. If a group builder or a small residential builder sends sort of pricing for you guys, elemental pricing, how do you guys, obviously have set rates within your business. Two-part question. Do you know your rough meter rate for standard frame and truss? That's a question we get all the time when guys are going to go price for, say, two duplex townhouses or dwellings, and if they can't get pricing back in time, do you know rough rates or what people should be putting? And then two, what's your guys' estimated turnaround time on material takeoffs estimates back to builder?
Yeah, so I'll go two first. If you come to us, you'll get it back within a week.
Yeah, cool.
So if you need it that quickly, you're probably unplanned. So I'd suggest that if you're not getting those rates back in time, I'd consider looking elsewhere.
Yeah.
And you know, can we give you a sort of rough guide? Yeah, we sort of can, but it is quite
very
tricky.
Vague. Yeah.
Two storied versus, you know, duplexes,
single story
versus
whatever.
So I'd say that, you know, we can just get it's a turnaround time that's probably more important, and we can give you, certainly, and that did blow out again at 6-8 months ago. It was taking a long time to get those that information back. But these days, I can almost guarantee you you'll get it within a week.
Yeah, yeah. I've been. I think speed of obviously for your general builder, 5 to 6 guys, speed getting back to clients is super key. So I'm always. We get a lot of questions, you know, how do we fire back an estimate really fast? I think that's how personally we get so busy, was we can do a ballpark takeoff, get it back to them. Once the contract gets like signed or fixed price, then they can go to the merchants, start negotiating with what we've estimated versus what suppliers would estimate and sub-trades, etc. But yeah, speed seems to be a big one for everyone across the board. Maybe not so much volume builders, but definitely the smaller residential guys, eh?
Yeah, I think it's for everyone. I think that the key is getting engaged. Once you've got me on the hook, so to speak, and we're talking about pricing and we're talking about your project, you've kind of got me. And I think that's why I think that is so important. You can engage with me early, give me anything, give me any idea about anything, and I can start having, you bring me into your fold.
Yeah. What's one thing you'd see builders say? I don't know how much of a sort of close relationship you have. Obviously, you've probably got your top 10 clients that you really look after, but what's sort of one thing, I don't know, maybe like a mistake or something they're doing differently versus the smaller builders to like reduce risk or cost blowouts, if you have any feedback there?
Yeah, look, I think there's one clear one for me, and I think we sort of touched on it earlier on, was the builders think that they've got the best rates for the slabs. They know the roofer, and he's given them the best rates, or the windows, or the insulation guy. So we call it supply, fix, and install. So
yeah, that's the word I was looking for.
Yeah. So we're really focused as a business on making sure that we can provide you a full service. So again, we because of our size, we're dealing with the big guys, and they're buying their kitchens, their roofing, their windows from us for a reason.
Yeah.
Price.
Yeah.
And so we've got great relationships with all those suppliers. So if you're a small to medium guy and you want to try and save time and save money, have one invoice, have one point of contact, that's the biggest thing we see from the big guys, is we get their full share of spend.
Full package.
And which is invaluable, clearly, to us. It makes that relationship really strong, and we can help. We know all the parts of the build. We can make sure that we're watching. If there's a delay in the slab going down, we can delay the frame and truss, or if there's an issue with the frame and truss, we can delay the project. And so that's the biggest single thing we're seeing from a cost point of view, is if you can find a partner that can provide you a broader supply of those other options, then you will, I guarantee you'll save money through time and through the money.
In regards to competition, obviously there's probably your four big players. We won't name them all today, but how do you, like, do you guys look at, do you constantly assess how your pricing is against them? And then do you find or know if your main clients are going to them for price comparisons as well? Or do you think you have that kind of loyal, we're going to give you the best rate, stay with us?
Look, we're all here to make a dollar, right?
For sure.
So it's, first of all, it's about relationship, and it's a trust thing. So we want you to make money. We're not trying to, we don't want to try to extract as much out of you as possible. And so you've got to be competitive. But for me, it starts off at that relationship side. So if you've got a great relationship with your account manager, he can save you time and money. It's not just how much you're paying for the stick of 4x2. It's will it arrive on time? Will it be straight when it turns up? What's the freight costs? Did I get what I wanted when I ordered it? So it's the service part of it as much as the cost. And I think that's the thing that we try to reinforce with our guys, is if you want the lowest price, then we can get there, but there's something that's got to give. And so I think from a relationship point of view, we'll do as best we can to get the price as low as possible.
Yeah.
To give you the best service, and it sounds a bit, I guess, cliche, but it's genuine. If you want the best product, you want straight and the quantities you want, and good service, then that's what we aim to do.
They say there's that that three tier, or the triangle. It's obviously cost, quality, and time, is it? And you can sort of only get two out of three. For your business, what's the most important two for you?
well, I guess all three, right?
We're
just trying to save you time. Our mantra is, we want to save you time and make you money. So if we can save you time, we know we'll make you money.
Yeah.
And so we've got to be competitive on price, and that's just table stakes for us. If we were $10 a meter and 4x2, you'd never use us or you know anybody else. So for us, table stakes, we're in the game. We know where our competitors are. We get plenty of feedback from our builders when they do price check, if that's what they do.
Yeah,
we don't get a lot of price checking, and I don't think we really encourage. It's a time waste. So if you think you need to do that, then you've probably got a really good relationship with the merchant you're using.
Yeah.
So, I think that's what we sort of focus on, is making sure we can give you good service.
Nah, good point. We did a takeoff for a guy. Oh, we do quite a lot of business with him, but frame and truss kickback. So we like added in. We usually just do upfront cost estimations, and then some jobs will kind of help and we'll update the sheets as the job's going, more on cost plus basis. But one was obviously a frame and truss kickback because of all the amount of planing and straightening and all that. Do you guys deal with that quite a bit? And fuck, is that a tough phone call? Sorting that shit out.
Yeah, it is, and that's probably the biggest area of frustration, is that the callbacks in frame and truss tends to be the issue that we deal with the most. I mean, most of the other stuff is, we just supply materials to you. The supply, fix, install area is the other one. Roofing can be tricky and contentious. Yeah. Kitchens are quite emotional for the homeowners, typically.
The defect checklist on kitchens, man.
Right, that sort of stuff. So I think it's some of those touchy-feely things are tricky. But your frame and truss. But again, our turnaround time on those is, if we've made a mistake or the detail has been detailed incorrectly, we get it fixed in a week and on we go.
On you go. Yeah, nice. In regards for that, like for your bigger materials that you're selling, frame and truss, insulation, jib, do you have a couple, do you have different clients that you go to for that? Or are you kind of mainly, like you said, you want to deal with one builder to do all your materials? Are you the same? Are you kind of giving all your business to one company to ensure you can get the best rates?
Typically, we're running sort of against two or three. We've got sort of, like in the timber space, we've got probably two main suppliers, but I would say we've got eight secondary suppliers, because some of them specialise in fence posts or railings or something or other else that the big guys won't be focused on. So we have a bit of a balance across, we pick and choose the horses that are going to be best for the business.
Yeah, nice. In regards to that, obviously, so if I wanted to get more of your business, what's some of the old sweet talking tactics that they've used? Free trips to Fiji or rugby tickets? what have you seen?
Yeah, I guess we've been around too long that it doesn't sort of wash anymore. We're kind of like a builder.
Yeah.
We just want the product to turn up.
For sure.
On time, when we want it, and we want you to be responsive. So, joking aside, we it's really about if you can look after us. And, the market currently with products like, say, Timber2 is in real tight supply. Now, all I want from a good supplier is that they give us some preferential treatment, or at least make me feel like I'm getting preferential treatment.
Yeah.
And if that's all they can do in a tight market, that I can make sure I can look after my clients, that's all I really need. So for us, our relationship with the suppliers is exactly the same as your relationship with a merchant. We just want to get looked after.
Yeah, for sure.
But the trip to Fiji wouldn't be
bad. Yeah, fucking hell.
Wouldn't be bad this time of year anyway.
Yeah. I feel like every other week, and a lot of people stress over this, but every other week there's a news article of, another builder going under or a volume builder liquidating. I mean, how do you look for those signs? And I mean, if you roll into the office on a Thursday and Noah Credit owes you $250,000 and then you see in the newspaper they've gone under, you can't predict that, but what's your thoughts on that? That must be tough.
Yeah, it is tough. Been around a dozen, 15 years, and so we've seen it all, and not that we're any better than anyone else. So the signs are pretty clear for us.
Yeah.
We do the credit checks before. So if you want to come to open an account with us, we do. We credit check you. We take trade insurance on our debt. That gives sort of a 90-day window, but we watch it like a hawk, and it's not that difficult. I think sometimes builders think they're clever or they're slow or they're smart. And we've heard all the excuses why they can't pay their bill this week or this month.
Yeah.
It's probably the single biggest concern for us as a business is getting paid, as I know it is from a builder's point of view as well.
100%, man. I feel like that's like the most commonly asked question, or just topic, like how do you get paid on time and how do you, you know, there's that thing from the accountant, you know, you're showing you're making a profit, but you've got no money left. And it must be, I mean, that must be just tough for you as well.
Just the same. Just you're probably, on a volume scale, right?
You're so, probably two more zeros.
yeah, right. And that's our biggest focus really, is making sure that we do get paid. And I think it's hard for some of the smaller builders sometimes to understand when we put them on stop credit and to say, look, we just can't take the risk anymore.
Yeah.
Because we're not your bank.
Yeah.
And sometimes it works and sometimes they pay. But again, it's that relationship. If you want to have a good relationship with your merchant, respect us as you want us to, you know, you want your product on time, you want the pricing, you want the service.
Yeah.
All we want is to be paid for that.
And absolutely.
So I think it's not too unfair to ask
either. Yeah, I love that. You aren't the bank. And I think builders not taking deposits is just like the most riskiest thing, because you shouldn't, I mean, I personally think you should be running, you know, a cash flow positive from the day you, I mean, I tell everyone, don't quote for free. Like, don't do a site visit for free.
Why would you?
You know, like, why would you go and spend $5,000 on Quiller decking when you haven't been paid yet? Like, you've got to, it should be, put your 15% on materials, get your $5,000 worth of decking, pay your 4.2 to Mitre 10, you're up $600. Charge your labor portion, make sure you hit it in 4 days, you're up, you know?
Couldn't agree more. I'm just doing I'm subdividing my house for 12 years, and I'm finally just going to go through the process. And it's actually through a friend who's doing the subdivision work, and and the first thing he did invoice. As a mate was sent me an invoice for a deposit in advance of, and I sort of joked and thought, gosh, you cheeky bugger.
Yeah.
But I also thought, how good's that, from a business point of view, that even as a friend he's charging me in advance. What a smart business. And I wish I could do the same thing. You could charge you before you get your frame of trust, or charge you before you got your job. But
I know, man.
Unfortunately, we can't.
I've literally just thought of that. Like, you know, builders are your, let's say, lifeline. You guys aren't charging up front. You're right down to 90 days. Is 120 your cutoff, or 90?
Oh, so we're 30 day, 20th of the month following, so it's a 60 day kind of, but yeah, it sometimes drifts out to 90 days, and it's a lot, especially on skinny margins, right? You know, some of these products you're making very
5%,
right? If you're lucky, the frame and truss can be at zero by the time you carry that, you know, that $50,000 frame and truss, and you know, and there's a defect, and there's, you know, freight, and it becomes quite tricky.
I've got to ask that question actually. Is it illegal for you guys to take money up front, or is that just a business model for, I mean, you go to a restaurant,
it's the market. So, you know, what would you do if you could get it free from a competitor? Well, not free, but you didn't have to put it up front. You'd probably use a competitor. So it's unfortunately the competitive market we work in, that if everyone did it. Look in America. We had a trip there recently to look around some stores, and amazingly, nobody leaves the store
until they're paid. Yeah.
Nobody.
Why are we not doing that here?
Nobody. And what they do, which is really really interesting, and I think it would be really, I don't know how widely it would be accepted, but I think it could be, they use credit cards. So if you go to like a Home Depot in the States, you get a Home Depot credit card, and you go and your bank has already pre-approved your overdraft of, pick a number, $100,000. And you go in with your credit card, you buy your jib, your frame and truss, whatever it is, and you swipe your card, and away you go. And from a merchant point of view, how good's that?
Yeah.
I got no risk. You know, I've got to pay a percentage to the bank to take the risk and to do the transaction. So I think that's something that I'd love to see in New Zealand. In fact, it's the same in Europe too. So,
Do you think, on that topic, do you think if, let's say you opened up a brand new trade store, do you think you would get customers signing up if that was a policy, or do you think it would just not, and if you could offer better rates?
Yeah, look, I guess there's a reason why it hasn't been done.
Yeah, sure.
It's certainly been looked at before.
Do you think anyone's tried it?
It's been looked at before. I just don't think, again, because you've got some big corporates Fletcher's, they've got lots of money, and Carter's, you know, got lots of money, they probably are funding themselves.
So yeah.
They're quite happy with the model they've got.
That's tough, eh? Everyone loves revenue numbers and stuff. Obviously, you say you doubled or times four your revenue in a year.
Yeah.
obviously anyone who sort of has their own business, does their own thing, you'd probably put them in the sort of killer category. How do you staff retention, hiring? How do you find good guys? What's something you look for? How do you go about that?
Yeah, so I guess for us, it's the same as any business, attitude. You know, it's old adage, hire attitude, and you can beat the rest of it into them. So I've been fortunate that I brought five really experienced account managers with me who were from a previous life, and so they were loyal to me and friendly with me. So I was lucky in that regard. And then just look after them once they're in your business.
Yeah, no, that's all good. I'm just trying to think if we want to go through anything more. What are your busiest periods of the month, quietest periods of the month, and how do you sort of like manage quiet periods, keeping everyone busy, stuff to do?
Yeah, for us, obviously, like a builder, month end is the worst. We've just gone through it yesterday, so it's when all the invoices are coming in from suppliers. Yep. We're trying to get all the invoices out to the to you guys. So for us, that last week of the month is probably the worst time to, from a merchant point of view. And then obviously the start of the month is kind of because you kind of wait to put your orders in post month end. So it's the first week of the month and the last week of the month are sort of the busy 2 weeks, and the middle two probably typically are the quieter ones.
Okay, cool. Last question. What are your goals for Mitre 10 for the next 5 years, and do you think you'll go for multi-ownership?
Yeah, I'd love to go for moderate ownership. We'll see if that opportunity comes up. What's our goals? It's just profitable growth, and I think it's easy. It's ego to double, triple, quadruple your business and make the same amount of money. And I think that's a risk that perhaps some of your builders, etc., get face as well sometimes. So our drive is to structure a business in a way that we can get profitable growth. And be a more profitable business is our drive.
Yeah, cool. I'm hoping we'll get some good views on this one. So any builders that are with Placemakers, why should they come over to Mitre 10 Manukau?
Come on in, the water's warm. To be fair, I'm big on loyalty. So if you've got a great relationship with a merchant,
why move?
I don't want to say it. Of course, I want you to come across, but. But if you were kind of looking for another solution, if you wanted to have that supply fix and install solution to discuss, if you wanted better turnaround, if you want a great relationship with people, we genuinely get trade in Auckland in particular. We've been around for 15 years. We've grown to be the biggest in Auckland at Placemakers. We kind of get what you do.
Yeah.
So if you want to deal with someone who gets what you do, you want a great relationship, then we'd love to have a chat. But equally, if you're happy with where you're at, stay where you are and just make sure that those things we've spoken about, you're getting it from your supplier, from your merchant. And if you're not, gosh, more the fool you. There's other options out there that I'd...
Cool. Nah, good as gold. I think we've covered a few good topics, and hopefully we'll get some good interest out of that one. Thanks for your time. Much appreciated.
Too easy.
Cheers, right. Mate.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Yo, guys, so I had a discussion with Chris after the podcast. He's agreed to give away a Makita radio and a brand new 5-amp battery on the side. RapidQS is also going to top it up with a $250 Mitre 10 gift card voucher. To be in to win, all you've got to do is put your company business name in the comments below and your email address, and we'll pick a winner from there. Cheers.